Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When sweet tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, they thought, why stop there? Why not create other exciting and unexpected combinations, like rainbows and ropes, or fruity and gummy, or chewy and more chewy? That's why they created fun treats like sweet tarts twisted rainbow ropes, gummies fruity splits, and chewy fusions. When you dare to combine, it's sure to blow your mind. Sweet tarts, dare to combine. Visit sweettartscandy.com to shop now.
Welcome to the Good Food Podcast. In this episode, Malika Bazou is joined by Angela Clutton to discuss cooking with seasonal ingredients and her favourite dish from childhood.
One of my mum's favourite meals that we love that she made was a broth, and actually it's the heart of one of the broths and seasoning, which is very much kale and leeks and lentils, and that was just something which just felt like so nutritious, but it felt like a hug, you know, one of those meals that just so hearty, just feels like a hug.
Plus, why eating seasonally can bring you so much joy.
A very warm welcome to you, Angela Clutton. Hello.
Oh, hello, honey. It's so nice to see you.
Oh, it's lovely to see you. Thank you so much for coming in.
My absolute delight.
Now, listen, I am very excited about your latest cookbook. And can I please tell you why?
Please.
Okay, because I know tons of people who receive vegetable boxes and don't have a clue with what to do with the veg and fruit in them. And so I think your new cookbook is going to be perfect for everyone who's in that situation. Tell me more.
These are my people, because I think that is something which a lot of people connect with. You know, they want to have a veg box for all the kind of, you know, good reasons of environmental and just ease as well, and enjoying the seasons, because my book is called Seasoning, How to Cook and Celebrate the Seasons. So at its heart, it is absolutely about embracing the seasonality of produce. Which all sounds great until you get to that sort of umpteenth week of celeriac appearing in your box, or parsnips, or even things which seem more joyous like tomatoes or courgettes. Because it's so easy, and we all do it, I do it, I bet you do it, get stuck in culinary ruts of doing the same thing on repeat over and over and over. And we get bored. And so I think that's one of the biggest challenges about maintaining an approach to seasonal cooking is boredom. So seasoning is, I hope, very, very much a book you can keep on reaching for to stave off that boredom, to just get an idea of a different way to use it, a different flavour partner you can put with it, ways to preserve that you may have not thought of before, and just keep on livening those things up, keep the interest. And I really believe that is the way to make sure that you can keep on cooking through the seasons and you don't get bored.
Absolutely. And the name is spot on as well, isn't it? Seasoning is what, you know, I love that your little take on season. But it's not just about the veg boxes. Like, how many of us can relate to just going into your local supermarket or your farmer's market and seeing veg? You know, kohlrabi is a classic example. Celeriac is another one. And you look at these things, fennel, you see them and you go, oh, I could do a salad maybe with some fennel shavings. But you'd love to know how to use it better and use it differently, just as part of your daily repertoire.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. So the book has, I think it's, you know, just over 50 different vegetables and fruits broken down through the seasons. And each one of them comes with little tips about when you're out shopping, what to look for, tips about how to store them for the best. So things like, don't wash your carrots. You know, they come with soil on. Treasure the soil. The soil will help keep them fresh.
Are you suggesting we eat carrots with soil on them, Angela?
I think you store them with the soil on, because that's going to keep them lovely and perky and fresh. And so it's things like that. And then it moves on to different ways to use. So cooking, not cooking, all different ideas of what you can do. And then flavour partners. And I think that's a really important part of it. Because even if you... I love roasting things. So I roast and roast and roast. And I do that a lot with so much stuff. And the way to keep that fresh is to think about the flavours and what different things you can kind of keep reaching for from the cupboard just to pop in there. So it's in-depth, comprehensive, I hope also really kind of easy to look at and see. You can pick it up, turn to fennel, such a good example, turn to fennel and kind of quickly see, okay, so I could poach it, or I could turn it into a nice pasta sauce, or I could roast it, or I can get a mandolin, or just really kind of slice it thinly and do it in a kind of vibrant winter autumnal salad. There's so many different things you can do. It's recipes. Each one of them comes with a couple of recipes. So there's like 75, 80 recipes through the book.
Lovely.
There's meat and fish seasonality woven through it as well. This is not a vegetarian cookbook. Vegetables and fruits are its absolute beating heart. But I really believe that the seasonality of meat and fish, and indeed dairy, are too often ignored and they're too important to ignore. So those are kind of woven through as well. So we have something about mackerel or about a duck and goose.
That's quite unusual, isn't it? I don't think I've come across that in a seasonal cookbook before. And that's lovely.
I think it really matters. Mm, it matters for environment, sustainability, and it matters for how we feel about different aspects of produce and the kind of meals we want to cook and eat and serve to our friends and family through the year. And I eat meat and fish, and I really enjoy having that arc through it as well. I'm thinking about dairy, goats and sheep's cheeses taste different in different times of the year.
It's fascinating.
It is. I love it. So those things are secondary to the vegetables and fruits, but they're very much in there. And for me, they feel a very important part of what seasoning is.
This is great. And so where did this inspiration strike from, Angela? How did you, because it sounds like it's a cookbook that should have been in existence for a long, long time.
Oh, well, that's a really lovely thing to say. I think this is the book I've wanted to write for an awfully long time.
Really?
This is my third cookbook, and it's the one I think that I have been kind of building up to. I have written and, felt very strongly about seasonality for a long time in my work. And I wanted to do something which was a seasonal cookbook that went beyond just recipes. And so it's very important to me that the book was as embracing as the book we've produced is. So it's the one that I've been building up to for a little while.
Have you? Can I just say, I love your first cookbook. Can we talk about vinegar, please, for
always,
a second?
Honey. I will talk about vinegar to people on the bus.
You wrote a whole book about vinegar and cooking with vinegar, and it's really darn good. It's like my encyclopedia of like vinegar, and I keep going back to it. I just think it's such a clever idea.
Oh, thanks. It's the Vinegar Cupboard, yeah.
The Vinegar Cupboard
came out in 2019, so that's 5 years ago now, I guess, isn't it? It's a book which really was important for me because it was my first book, and I wanted to do it because I think there's something really exciting about an ingredient like vinegar, which is kind of taken for granted. We all, it's taken as being so ordinary, and actually is completely extraordinary. Most of us, most people listening, you and I certainly will have at least one bottle of vinegar in the cupboard. And you just kind of, you do just take it for granted. And I wanted to kind of show there's so much more behind it, both in terms of what it can do for your cooking, that so often when you're tasting something as you're about to kind of, serve it, and it's a bit like, almost. Often what it needs is a burst of acidity. We're also used to reaching for salt to kind of balance flavour, and obviously that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
But acidity is often the lift that's needed. And vinegar is a brilliant way of delivering that. So I wanted to get into that idea to kind of, show people more how vinegar can really kind of bring your food to life. But I also wanted to get into discovering what different vinegars mean around the world. So what does rice vinegar tell you about Japan and China?
Mm-mm. I mean, these are cultural products, deeply cultural products.
Exactly.
And every nation has its own form of vinegar. And it's very much based on sort of climate, geography, produce. And
completely.
That's so
exactly
much nuance.
It. So you think about the wine vinegars in Europe. You think about apple cider vinegar in the States. You think about fruit and vegetable vinegars. They tell you so much about where they're from and the people and the history and the culture of how they've been produced over the years.
I just love that. I mean, you you and I can basically talk vinegar for the rest of this podcast. I reckon between seasonal ingredients and vinegar, that's us done. But I'd love to talk a little bit about how you grew up with food, Angela, and like talk me through what it was like. What was your favorite dish when you were growing up, like sitting with the family eating? What was it like?
So my mom was amazing. She did, you know, fresh meal every day, but it was very basic stuff. So I'm from Lancashire. I'm from Blackburn in Lancashire. So it would be like, you know, if I say hot pot, that sounds like such a cliche, but genuinely, like she did cracking hot pot. She also did one of my mum's favourite meals, or we love that she made, was a broth. And actually, it's the heart of one of the broths and seasoning, which is very much kale and leeks and lentils. And that was just something which just felt like so nutritious, but it felt like a hug, you know, one of those meals
so hearty,
just feels like a hug. But my mum, you know, she was just, I'm the youngest of three girls. There wasn't, you know, a load of money flying around the house. My mum was just cracking on and doing it. So I didn't cook at home, I'm going to say, at all. I left home with an awareness of the value of home-cooked food. And even if I didn't really know how to articulate that, I knew that it played such an important part in our family life and how we rolled as a unit. But I did leave without any idea really about how to cook, because she was too busy to kind of teach us how to do it, or even to kind of have us involved doing it. So I grew up with a respect and a love for home food, but no sort of real skills or experience to back that up. And then over the course of life, happily kind of learnt, taught myself books, and I just became so immersed. This is very much second career for me, but I eventually got so immersed in it that, you know, here I am, you know, with my third cookbook.
I love that. And flavour thing's quite interesting for you as well, isn't it? Because I don't know where you picked that up, but I'm pretty certain I've seen a recipe from you for cheesecake with mixed peppercorns.
Oh yeah, you're so right.
So there's somewhere. I mean, these recipes just sit in my brain somewhere. And
You have an encyclopedic knowledge of everyone's recipes.
What on earth inspired that? But it's so good. That's very clever.
Really nice one. So that was from my second cookbook. That was the Borough Market, the Knowledge book. And that is a baked cheesecake with stem ginger chopped into the biscuit
base.
Gives a lovely kind of, you know, kick.
Warm. So you'll get a lovely warmth in that. Is it ginger nut biscuits or just regular?
No, it's stem ginger. So it's just digestive.
Digestive,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, with stem ginger chopped in. And then over the top, once it's done, out the oven and everything, you drizzle over some of the syrup in the stem ginger jar and some pink peppercorns.
That's what it is.
And it looks so pretty.
Because I made all my Christmas cooking from that cookbook 1 year. And I did your Gravid Lax and it was excellent. So the recipes do work as well. And I can say
Bless you. Because
I know I have tried. So we're going to do a round of confessions now. Are you ready for this?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Be very afraid.
Okay, I am.
What's been your biggest cooking disaster, Angela?
Christmas Day, not this year, last year, when the sort of younger guys in my husband's family, they want Yorkshire puddings for their Christmas dinner. A single oven. It's very hard to do turkey. Like, that comes out resting, fine. But then you've got your potatoes, pigs in blankets, a million pigs in blankets, parsnips, carrots, like all the stuff. And then Yorkshire puddings, like that's hard. So I tried to deliver the Yorkshire puddings with the Christmas meal. Disaster.
No.
Yeah.
And there is a question mark, isn't there, over whether you need to have Yorkshire puddings.
I don't feel it's a question mark.
No.
I think it's
a big
cross.
It's a must.
No, I think it's a must not.
Oh, really?
But why wouldn't? But, you know, you're trying to do the Christmas Day thing.
You really are.
You're trying to make everyone happy.
And the Christmas meal is such, you know, it's set up for disasters, isn't it? Almost like so many things could go wrong.
Yeah, yeah. So, normally, I probably wouldn't care my Yorkshire puddings failed. On Christmas Day, it's like...
Not good. Don't worry, a lot of our listeners are now nodding completely in agreement. Like, this is a relatively well-known cooking disaster. Welcome. So, have you ever served something ready-made and pretended that it's one you made yourself?
I'm going to sound so smug. No. Sorry, can't lie.
All right, smug.
I led for saying I was going to sound smug.
But you must have a guilty pleasure.
Hula hoops.
Hula hoops.
Love a hula hoop.
Do you thread them on your fingers before eating them?
No, I just eat them.
You just eat them straight out of the packet? No. Do you eat them with anything?
I do. I have them with a martini. It's like clash of styles there, isn't it?
Okay.
So like, yes. Oh, so elegant with my...
I don't know what to say anymore.
With my dirty martini with a stash of hula hoop straight out the packet. Not like on a fancy plate or anything. Just, you know, lovely martini.
Not like this matters, but I'm guessing a classic, like a salted version of the hula hoops. You're not going for a flavour.
No, I think that would clash with the martini probably too much.
No, I can't imagine you're a salt and vinegar kind of girl anyway for
a hula
hoop.
Well, the vinegar obviously, you know, yes. It wins in some respects, but possibly not with the martini.
That's hilarious. So what about drinks then? Now we're talking about martinis, we're going to have to talk about drinks. Do you touch on them as well in your cookbook?
Yeah. You know, every season in the book, so we do the classic four seasons, every season finishes with a cocktail. I think as we have possibly just established, I do like a cocktail. So every season finishes with a seasonal cocktail, which is also made by including some of the seasonal produce. So in autumn, I have a recipe for turning figs into figuratafia that then turns into a champagne cocktail. I know.
That sounds very, very
nice. And then we have elderflower in the spring, so elderflower cordial. Lots of people love that. But then mixing it with sherry into a kind of long Collins. So lots of lovely, you know, ice and everything, some soda water in there. Forced rhubarb, you know, that becomes a rhubarb gimlet. So I think it's really interesting thinking about how seasoning stretches out beyond food into drinks as well. So the feasting that we have in seasoning, it very much kind of brings those things together. Because I wanted to feel that our approach to seasonality just becomes part of enjoying life. I think that's
totally
such a big thing for me about why I wanted to write seasoning, why I am so deeply proud of it, and why I think it sort of matters that we think about the seasons, that it connects us with the land, really.
Of course, and that matters. It does. And isn't there that big, I mean, there's a big move about having more diversity in our diets as well. And I do think that, I don't know if this is your experience, but it's quite difficult to experiment with fruit and veg beyond a very small range because the know-how just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So, you know, a supermarket range, and often like a smaller supermarket range, will be quite limited. And that's pretty much the kind of, you know, the remit of most people's home cooking repertoire. Whereas actually, if you start learning about all these other fruit and veg that you can buy in, you know, farmers markets, farm shops, smaller independent retailers, then, you know, you just need to actually know what to do with them once you've bought them.
I think that's really right. And I do think that we as shoppers, we have quite a lot of power, really, to go to the supermarket and say, you know, do you have, could you get? And, you know, consumer power isn't to be ignored, I don't think.
I think so.
The supermarkets, they can maybe make those aisles a little bigger for the fruits and vegetables and just have a few more.
I started looking for strange vegetables. I call them strange vegetables, but essentially just slightly wider range of vegetables. And so I've got some turnips sitting in my freezer now. I know, you'll be happy to hear. So
what you can do with them?
I might have also made a mistake in my shop and bought two extra portions of turnips. So
I'll lend you the book, honey. You can have a little look at what's doing. I'll take
a little photo if you don't mind. Drinking with the seasons, of course, covers non-alcoholic drinks as well.
Absolutely.
And there's, again, a huge variety that you can do. And there's a big movement on that front as well, because, you know, people are watching their alcohol intake. And I know, like, I love a bar, love a drink. But, you know, there are interesting things you can do. And
absolutely right. You know, the rhubarb cordial that I was mentioning a few moments ago, yes, in the book, I suggest turning it into an alcoholic cocktail. But that same recipe also has ways to use it which aren't alcoholic. So you have your lovely forced rhubarb, and then you can make it into a cordial, which obviously means you can extend its season. And then it's such a gorgeous thing to have and to reach for, and just simply with some sparkling water and lots of ice and maybe some, you know, mint or some basil in there as well. And because you've made the cordial, you know what's in it. Often so many cordials that you buy in the shops, they are absolutely packed with sugar and preservatives, obviously. How gorgeous just to get in the rhythm of making your own. And I think that applies to so many of the fruits in who are in the book, you know, about how to kind of make those cordials, and then just
that.
Keep on enjoying them right through the year.
Oh, I love the sound.
Because they
of
freeze
that.
So well too.
Do they freeze as well? I don't know if I could physically put anything else in my freezer.
Get the turnips out. Cook those. And then you can make some rhubarb cordial.
This is a good point. Give the turnips away maybe at this point. Things are getting a little bit desperate in my kitchen, Angela. I have some quick fire questions.
We're through the confessions. Can I relax from the confessions?
I think you probably can. Oh, yes, we've done the confessions, so you can breathe slightly easier, not fully easy yet. And I always say that we mustn't linger on these quickfire questions, but we tend to, so don't worry about it too much. What is your least favorite kitchen job?
Washing up. Everyone's going to say washing up, but washing up a grater specifically.
The grater?
A grater.
Why? Nails?
Because maybe nails. Things just get stuck, don't they? It's tedious.
Messy, right? Ugh. Nobody loves washing up, by the way. I'll tell you what. We're going to have to look at this question more closely. Favorite kitchen job. What do you love doing in the kitchen?
Squeezing fruit. Quite satisfying.
Manually.
I can't believe I just said that. I've not thought about this before.
Not going to read into that too much. That came really quickly as well.
Do I find squeezing limes that pleasing? I think perhaps I do. Because it's quite a therapeutic action. I'm trying to keep going. This. Quite quick end results. I would like to have a different answer, but we'll have to roll with that
one. This is fine. We're just going to stick to this. That's absolutely fine. Do you eat sandwiches, by the way?
I do. Can I have my lunch?
Yes, please.
I had the lunch of dreams.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
I had a fish finger sandwich.
Oh, no. Where did you do this?
Just at home.
I love that.
Some brilliant white bread, fish fingers, nothing on it, no fancy like tartar sauce or anything. White bread, fish fingers, lovely. I could have put some crisps in my fish finger sandwich for the win, but it was pretty good.
And are these just regular fish fingers?
Yeah.
Nothing fancy.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, now you're making me crave one. So we haven't talked about how you got into cooking, but what's the best kitchen tip you've received? And then let's talk a little bit about how you got into cooking in the first place.
The best kitchen tip, I think, is if it goes wrong, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about it too much. Perfection is definitely overrated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And just, you know, what I try and do in my work generally, but definitely in cookbooks and very definitely in seasoning, is try and give people a little bit of confidence. I want to empower home cooks just to kind of feel it and just roll with it. And maybe don't follow recipes too slavishly. Just build more of a confidence. And I think you can only really do that if you accept that tip of it's okay. It doesn't matter if it's not completely perfect.
And that's a good one because, you have to kind of relax into cooking,
definitely,
don't you?
That's when you become an intuitive cook, when you sort of accept that you can just sort of try things, make things up. Some of them are going to be amazing. Some of them possibly aren't. Some you'll do again. Some you absolutely never will. That's all part of it. And that's when I think you move from, maybe being quite a perfunctory cook into something where you can really kind of embody it, and it doesn't sound sort of, too ridiculous, kind of be at one almost with the food you're creating.
But I know what you mean, because as food writers, you're often having to be quite specific and, judicious about the ingredients or the messages. But it does sometimes get in the way of just natural instinct and having a bit of fun.
I think that's really right.
And someone told you that at some point?
I think I got it. So I'm going to join on to the question that I think you were just about to ask me about how I kind of got into it, that I started doing quite a bit of... I did history at university, I did classics, and so I was always quite interested in what food tells you about people, place, and time. And so I got into thinking about food history and reading some older cookbooks. And although, kind of say Jane Gregson, so not that much older, we're only sort of talking 70s really, but I was reading some of the Jane Gregson, and I think that idea of things not having to be perfect and just sort of feeling it and enjoying it, that vibe came through. So yes, someone told me it was reading the Jane Gregson cookbooks, which was then such a foundation stone for me into moving into cooking more, having a greater understanding of ingredients and produce and then wanted to do that myself.
That sounds wonderful. And look, if you read Jane Grigson and Angela inspires you today, then we can go on to do great things as well with seasonal ingredients, maybe write a few cookbooks, I don't know.
Why not?
So do you always clean up after you cook? You don't enjoy washing up. So what then happens?
No, I do. I'm quite particular about that.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. Again, it's quite satisfying. It's done. It feels like it's part of the job. Mm-hmm. You got to do it. I'm not a fan of leaving it to linger.
Oh, you're not?
Do you?
It's the mode I do sometimes. Yeah. Isn't that horrible?
I've even cleaned up the fish fingers from lunch before I came here.
Yeah. Oh, goodness, you've had an exciting day, haven't you? Fish finger sandwich.
I squeezed some limes.
Eating a fish finger sandwich. Cleaned up after yourself. Fancy that.
Then living the dream.
Studio. Excellent. Do you have a trusted recipe? You know, is there a most trusted recipe that you keep going back to that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, gosh. Of my own or of somebody else's? No, somebody
Any,
else's.
Whichever.
Well, I'm going to say that there's a Felicity Cloak recipe for a birthday. I'm not a great baker. I prefer savoury to sweet. But Felicity Cloak has a recipe in her A to Z. What's it called? The A to Z of eating? Is that
yes.
What it's called? I think so. And she has a really gorgeous kind of Maltesery, Horlicksy chocolate cake. And that is like our family's go-to like birthday cake for people. So that I would say for people who kind of want to make a nice, simple, delicious, it kind of, you know, looks really beautiful too, in a simple way you can decorate it, Maltesers or biscuits or whatever.
Is it? Ooh, that's a top tip. I love a good cookbook recommendation, by the way. Those are always so welcome from food writers. Is there a really overrated food? Is there something that you just think is overvalued? You don't see what the point is.
Well, I'm possibly going to upset people, but tahini. I know, I'm sorry, darling.
Tell me why.
I just don't get it.
Really?
I just don't get it.
What is it? The taste? You don't get the taste?
I think the texture possibly doesn't really do it for me. Maybe the taste.
So the cloyingness of it, that is quite special,
just,
isn't it?
I know I need to grow to love it.
Mm.
And I feel this is a personal failing. It's my fault, not the tahini's fault.
Tahini.
But yeah.
I wonder how many other people don't like tahini. The worst thing you've ever eaten.
Bananas and custard. Don't have to think about that.
No.
School days. Don't like bananas. I love custard, but not cold custard. Sliced bananas in cold custard.
That's so weird.
Have you
it's
had
like
it?
Gloop like, on gloop.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't.
Oh,
that just sounds.
No, they did with school dinners.
I also like school dinners are an interesting one, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, it just brings me out and you know, shakes.
You guys had
about
spam,
it.
Didn't you?
Mm.
There was spam on the menu.
Yeah, and the worst thing about the bananas and custard was that they would put sort of little like vermicelli chocolate bits on top. Like that was going to make it better.
Hey, vermicelli bits of chocolate make everything better.
Well, I suppose so.
Chocolate
but
makes everything, but no. And also, I'm sure these things don't taste of anything.
No.
They're chocolate sprinkles.
No.
What's
no.
the point of
They
that?
Were expecting a lot of those little chocolate sprinkles to deliver.
But also, like, bananas texturally are quite difficult for some people. And then you've paired that with, like, cold, gloopy custard.
Not good.
Which really should be warmed. I have to say, I've never taken to custard. Like, I've lived here 28 years, but I'm originally from India and I've just never wrapped my head around.
Can I ask you to try a recipe from seasoning
okay.
that I firmly believe might change your mind?
Okay. We might be on. Is this some kind of gauntlet?
It's a mini gauntlet. So it is strawberries that are roasted with some sumac.
Mm.
And then you layer them up in a glass with kind of zabaglione, warm custard. So you have roasted strawberries, zabaglione, some more roasted strawberries on top with some of the roasted strawberry juices as well. It's very
and
nice.
And also roasted strawberries with sumac, which is this chili, this quite a berry.
Such
a
great fit.
You know, fruity chili with, that just sounds wonderful, actually.
And that's a really good example, actually, of what I was trying to say earlier about a big point of seasoning, that strawberries, you can do more than just, you know, slice them and have them cold from the fridge, which is clearly a sensational thing to do. But lovely to kind of, you know, get in the groove of roasting them and see what that can do to their flavour and then what that can do to helping them unite with other flavours that you might not think of, like sumacs.
So one food that you enjoy that your family just won't go near, is there anything? Because you're an adventurous eater, like you have a big range of things that you will have in your diet and your palate.
That's I'm going to say fennel, actually.
Really?
But I love fennel. There's something about that kind of like aniseedy thing. Maybe the slightly bitter thing connects with why I enjoy vinegar so much. So
yes,
maybe there's a flavour kind of correlation there. So I would have fennel sort of as a side on and with kind of everything.
Right.
My husband, James, doesn't feel quite so passionately in favour of fennel. So I'd say, yeah, maybe that's one that's...
Fennel
more
is not
me
so.
Than the family.
I love that. Listen, this is great. I'm all over this. So three cookbooks now, and obviously we've got seasoning. And so, you know, what are you optimistic about? What are you looking forward to, Angela?
I am really looking forward to seasoning coming out. I know Manicure, it's a book that means a lot to me. I've worked, you know, on it for quite a long time. As I said earlier, it's a book I've been building up to, and I am, to be honest, really quite terrified about it coming out, because it feels like a really big deal for me, because it's a book I really believe in. I'm deeply proud of it. The team have worked to make it an absolute beauty. So for me at the moment, it is very much all eyes on seasoning and getting that into the big wide world, and really hoping that people enjoy cooking from it, and that people manage to feel inspired by it, and that it can become a friendly voice in the kitchen. And then we'll see. I think also I'm quite keen to take a little bit of a break. I went from one book straight into another, and that can be quite hard for
a lot. I don't think people realize, by the way, that, you know, it's a long process to write a book, and, you know, it can really drain you in terms of...
I mean, how lucky am I to write a cookbook? But it is quite tiring as well. So yeah, I'm one of those people who can be guilty of chasing too much. I'm not necessarily naturally gifted in enjoying the moment. So I'm going to try really hard just to stay still, enjoy this, and then see what's next.
I think that sounds very sensible. Well, listen, good luck. I am optimistic that people will cook seasonally more with seasoning. So there you go. See what I did there?
See what you did there.
And it, you know, it just sounds like a really, really good cookbook. And good luck with it all. And thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Lovely to see you.
And you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Good Food Podcast. Join us next week when Donal Skiam will be chatting to me, Samuel Goldsmith, about food from Ireland and LA, as well as his love of Eurovision. Don't forget, our bonus cook-along episode is out on Thursday. For more recipes and inspiration, please visit goodfood.com or download our app.